from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Throughout the 90s, Wall Street's giants gorged on the mountain of money that eager investors dumped in their laps, with analysts screaming buy in an endless stream of startups to take public. The bigwigs on the street were dancing over all kinds of ethical lines. But if you want to dance, you've got to pay the piper. First, a vast market collapse, and now, New York Attorney General Eliot Spitzer. One of the biggest scandals ever to hit Wall Street came to settlement this week when the top 10 investment firms agreed to pay a fine of $1.4 billion for issuing fraudulent stock recommendations. Armed with thousands of pages of internal documents and incriminating emails, Spitzer exposed Wall Street's deeply cynical dark side. In an effort to pump the stocks of their bank's clients, analysts pushed equities they were privately deriding as laugh-out-loud lousy. Everybody plays a part in a stock bubble, but the big house's part was pretty ugly this time, confidence-busting. Is a $1.4 billion settlement enough to make Wall Street change its ways? Does it make you feel better about investing your money? Or is this just a slap on the wrist? Would honest stock analysis have made a difference to 90s investors? Can the U.S. economy thrive again without a return to trust? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is James Sirwicki, financial columnist for The New Yorker magazine. James, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on.
It's good to have you. So, James Sirwicki, are the giants of Wall Street heading out to the Hamptons this weekend to open up their houses in a chastened mood?
Well, I think it's somewhat of a mix. I mean, some Wall Street firms are obviously chastened, and Sandy Weill being banned essentially from talking to any analysts, and Henry Blodgett of Merrill Lynch and Jack Rubman of Solomon Smith Barney were banned from the profession and are both having to pay pretty hefty fines. But there are certainly CEOs of these companies. I mean, the two most obvious ones being Philip Purcell of Morgan Stanley and Stanley O'Neill of Merrill Lynch, who don't seem that chastened at all, because basically in the last week they have come out with statements basically saying, we didn't really do much, that effectively said we did not do much wrong, and investors need to essentially stop crying about this. So I think it's really a kind of mix. I mean, I think the settlement was interesting and important in a lot of ways, but it would be too much to expect it to suddenly transform Wall Street, I think.
So walk us through, I guess, first, the $1.4 billion. What kind of weight does that have when it lands on the shoulders of these firms? Is it nothing? Is it something? Who's paying what? And how significant is the pure number?
I think the number is sort of in between. For some of these firms, $200 or $300 million, which is what I think quite a few of them are paying, is a pretty significant number. And you already saw that sort of effect, I think, in terms of their earnings. But for some of the other firms, let's take Citigroup, which I think is paying $300 million, the most of any of the companies.
Yeah.
I think Citibank actually earned maybe $10 billion last year. So $300 million is, relatively speaking, insignificant. So I think in terms of the actual numbers, it's probably not a massive hit. On the other hand, it is the biggest fine, I think, ever in the history of Wall Street. And, it's $1.4 billion is a number that does catch the eye even these days. So I think that there's something to that. In terms of where the money is going, it's sort of this kind of strange blend. I think about $400 million is being set aside for restitution for investors. We could talk about that. I think that's not necessarily such a great idea. Another about $400 million is going to go to essentially fund independent research that these firms will be required to make available to their clients in the future. And that's obviously a kind of important structural change. So, that's kind of interesting. And it's $1.4 billion is a big number. But in the context of Wall Street, I don't think it's actually certainly not sending any of these firms out of business.
And $400 million in restitution, is that going to show up to every investor, to a few investors? Who will actually get those pennies, decipennies on the dollar?
It's kind of a mess. I mean, restitution is a sort of very difficult thing for the government to handle. And, you are talking about a lot of investors. The truth is, that number is kind of interesting, but not all that important, because one of the good things about the settlement is that investors who file for restitution will not, by doing so, give up their right to sue the companies. And that, I think, is where the potentially huge money is going to come.
That Eliot Spitzer has laid down the track for a bunch of lawsuits now to travel on?
Right. I mean, the other thing that's about the settlement that's important in that regard is that the emails, you know, that were essentially the foundation of Spitzer's investigation were not being kept private. They were released to the public, and class action lawyers are just salivating over those. So, you know, I mean, there have been estimates. People have said things that, you know, the firms could end up paying $15 or $20 billion. And, you know, if you look at what juries have done, say, in the cigarette cases, where clearly a lot of that is just sheer anger at Philip Morris, you could imagine juries being, you know, more than willing to punish Wall Street for what's happened.
So that $15 or $20 billion, there we get in the territory of a serious blow, if indeed it should ultimately land.
Yeah, that would be immense. I mean, that would be very, very big. And, you know, I know the Wall Street firms are still trying to deal with, you know, the question of basically can they get their insurers to pay for some of this? And, you know, those are sort of interesting questions. But if the class action suits develop in the way that some people are suggesting, or even if they're individual suits, even if it's not even class action, the numbers could be pretty huge.
James Sirwicki, take us back to some of the scenes of the crime, as it were, here. And the word fraudulent, is part of this settlement. Some of our listeners will know very well what went on. Others will not. Give us some of those emails and the context. What was going on that was so very wrong, so confidence-destroying?
Well, I think there are kind of two separate things. The first, and arguably the most important, certainly the most sort of glamorous, this is what most of the emails had to do with, was that, you know, Wall Street essentially does two different things. Well, they do a variety of things, but let's say they do two important things. One is they deal with corporate finance. So they, you know, raise money for corporations, both in the form of selling stock and also, you know, selling bonds, essentially, for corporations. The second thing they do is they are supposed to provide independent research for individual investors, primarily their own clients. You know, Citigroup, Salomon Smith Barney has a lot of individual clients who have their money managed by that company, and, you know, whose brokers, they give their money essentially to brokers to manage it.
And they want to know, buy, sell, or hold. What shall I do with these stocks?
Right, exactly. And the biggest problem in the late 90s was that the analysis function essentially became a tool of the investment banking department, so that instead of analysts offering independent, serious, critical analysis of companies, they essentially, in the simplest terms, were shilling for companies and basically recommending that people buy these stocks, because that was a way to get companies to use them for their investment banking business.
So to cut to the heart of it, it's wink, wink, nod, nod, young.com company, use us to raise your next $50 million, and you're going to get such a glowing analysis that your IPO will be off the charts.
Yeah, but, you know, the thing about it is it wasn't just young.com companies. I mean, some of the most egregious examples, perhaps the most egregious example was Jack Grubman, the telecom analyst for Salomon Smith Barney. And many of the companies that he was out there pushing and recommending were, you know, big telecom companies like AT&T and WorldCom. And, you know, the idea there was not that WorldCom was going to go public. The idea was that WorldCom was going to do a bond offering, and, you know, they would rely on Salomon Smith Barney to do it. You know, one of the extraordinary numbers is, even if you set aside the Internet, I think something like $600 billion in bond issues were raised by the telecom industry in the late 90s. That is a huge sum of money, all of which, you know, Wall Street wanted its chunk of. So, you know, you had Jack Grubman essentially recommending stocks, even as at the same time he was sending emails talking about, you know, what dogs they were. You had Henry Blodgett, and this is an example of the dot-com stuff you were talking about, you know, issuing buy or continuing to hold to issue buy recommendations on stocks that he was, you know, literally using vulgar terms to describe, and basically saying there's nothing going on here except the fact that they're willing to give us fees for investment banking.
So this wasn't subtle. I mean, it's right there in the emails. This is a laugh out loud lousy stock, but let's push it anyway. Or this is they had all their acronyms, the POS, piece of you
right.
know what.
Exactly.
But we're pushing it anyway, and you know why.
Right. Exactly. I mean, there were. I mean, I think one of the extraordinary things about these emails is actually how explicit they are. You know, one of the other things, some of the most interesting emails actually come from Salomon Smith Barney brokers, who had been relying on Jack Grubman's analysis and, you know, basically using it to put their investors into telecom stocks. And the emails from Salomon Smith Barney brokers in the last year or so of, you know, the period that we're talking about, so I guess it'd be 2000 to 2001, are extraordinary, because they're saying things like, Jack Grubman should win the award for most wealth destroyed. You know, Jack, why does this guy continue to get paid as a research analyst when all he is a shill for investment bankers? And, you know, the brokers themselves are basically saying there's something deeply wrong here. Why don't you fix it? And yet the company, you know, continued to pay Jack Rubman. I think he was paid something like $20 million in his last year.
On and on. So that splitting that $19 million fine with Henry Blodgett won't exactly break him. James Surowiecki, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Los Angeles, Arianna Huffington, syndicated columnist, author of Pigs at the Trough. Good evening and welcome, Arianna Huffington.
Good evening. How are you?
Very, very well. Thanks for joining us. Good to have you back. Arianna,
thank you so much.
You know, the New York Times is calling this $1.4 billion settlement a landmark settlement. Do you see this as returning trust to the American investor? Do you see it as cleaning up whatever was wrong on Wall Street?
Unfortunately not. I think that Eliot Spitzer made a great effort to restore trust, but he came up against very strict resistance. And unfortunately, the worst thing about that settlement is that nobody is admitting wrongdoing. And until you have companies and wrongdoers admit wrongdoing, there's going to be no restoration of trust. And that's really the main point I'm making in Pigs at the Trough. And that's the main point that was proven again when the head of Morgan Stanley, immediately after the settlement was announced, was going around saying that there was no contrition, that they hadn't done anything to hurt the small investors, and all the things that were clearly not the case.
James Surowiecki, just clarify that for us. Was there nothing in this settlement that required them to concede that they'd done something wrong? Nothing at all?
No, well, you know, it was one of these classic that the firms neither admitted nor denied that they had done anything wrong. So, this is the way this stuff gets done. It's why it's a settlement instead of, actually bringing them to court. I mean, I agree with Arianna I'm just kind of tired of this in everything that we've seen over the last 2 years. At some point, you know, you want to just say, screw it, we're just going to go to court, basically, and prove that these guys did something wrong. So I think that, you know, what was really striking about Philip Purcell's comment was he essentially seemed to be denying that things were, you know, that he had done something wrong.
What he had just settled over. Arianna, speak to the culture here for a moment, the culture that produced this kind of, ethical holiday. How did it grow up? Has it changed? What would it take to change it?
Well, I think what it would take is to stop this kind of business as usual of not having to admit wrongdoing. Because what really that says is that we have two kinds of America where different laws and different rules and regulations apply. Because if you or I were caught stealing $200 worth of groceries, just try telling the policeman that you are neither going to confirm or deny, right?
Yeah.
But if you're caught red-handed defrauding the American investing public to the tune of billions of dollars, you can get away with it. And that is really what I think we are most upset with.
So what's so hard about changing that? What's so hard about bringing back a little bit of black and white, a little bit of right and wrong to Wall Street? Why hasn't it happened yet, if it hasn't?
Well, because there are huge stakes here involved, you know, multi-billion dollar potential claims in class action suits.
But Eliot Spitzer's not on the payroll of Wall Street. Mr. Donaldson, new chairman of the SEC, he's not on the payroll of Wall Street.
No, but don't forget, a lot of them blink when it comes to taking on Citigroup and Sandy Weill and the powerful people involved.
Blink as in they're just not going to step up and pursue this to the full extent of the law? Do you think they're blinking in that way, Arianna Huffington?
Well, I'm thinking, you know, Eliot Spitzer, who I have to admit is a major hero in my book because compared to everybody else, he's the best. But nevertheless, he wants to run for governor of New York. Sandy Weill and many of the others are a huge part of the New York Democratic establishment. Unfortunately, all these things come into play.
So are you talking about a kind of invulnerable financial aristocracy here that just won't really be hit?
That is certainly going to steal it. Hello?
I'm sorry. Yes,
I said this is such a good line, I'm going to steal it. An invulnerable aristocracy, financial aristocracy. I love it.
I guess that's a yes.
that's more than a yes.
All right. Well, there it is in all its invulnerability. Arianna Huffington, thank you for joining us for a couple of minutes tonight.
Thank you so much.
James Surowiecki, please stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about whacking Wall Street, the big Wall Street firm's $1.4 billion settlement this week for systematically misleading investors and where it leaves investor confidence in America. Is this $1.4 billion settlement justice served or a slap on the wrist? Are the sharks out of the Wall Street water yet? Will they ever be? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking tonight about whacking Wall Street, the big Wall Street firm's $1.4 billion settlement this week for systematically misleading investors. Fraudulent advice was the word. And where this all leaves investor confidence in America now, you can join the conversation. Were you part of the investor stampede that the stock analysts encouraged? Would honest analysis of equities, honestly now, would it have dissuaded you, or would you still have leapt at the bubble? And are you confident that America's equity markets are now honest? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined tonight by James Surowiecki. He's financial columnist for the New Yorker magazine, and now from Swarthmore, Pennsylvania, by Samuel Hayes. He's professor emeritus at Harvard Business School. He's consulted for many corporations, financial institutions, government agencies, including the Department of Treasury, the Justice Department, the SEC. Good evening and welcome, Samuel Hayes.
Hi, nice to be here.
Very nice to have you. Samuel Hayes, how do you see this settlement this week? What's landmark about this and what's not?
Well, I think it's landmark in as the previous speakers have said, in that it's the largest fine that has ever been levied, and it involves more firms than any previous scandal except for the antitrust action against the Wall Street as a total community in the 1940s.
So there's scale, but what about at the level of substance? Has something in the chemistry between law enforcement and the street changed this week or not?
I would say there has been a nuanced change. I wouldn't call it a landmark shift, a total shift, but I think this is more than a slap on the wrist. I think this is a slap on the face. And it's not, as Mr. Zawicki pointed up, it's not the money. At least it's not the $1.4 billion. It may well be the specter of a multi-billion dollar settlement with civil suits later. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. it's more the public humiliation which has been visited upon these this aristocracy, as Ms. Huffington mentioned a few minutes ago.
But do you think that is real, despite Philip Purcell stepping right back out in the limelight this week and saying essentially we've done nothing wrong? Is that just keeping your game face on? Is there real shame, humiliation, you put the word on it, in the halls of power here?
Yes, I think there is. I think this is posturing and trying to put the best face, particularly in the face of inevitable civil suits that will be coming down the pike. I think that when you get a situation in which, just to take one example, as Mr. Zawicki pointed up, when Sandy Weill is not allowed to talk to a research analyst unless there's a lawyer in the room, that does not bespeak not admitting guilt. And I think everybody understands that the reality is this was an admission of guilt. They've put legal wrapping paper around it to try to minimize their potential future liability, but it is humiliation for the street.
Spelling that out, this is Sandy Weill, one of the real titans of Wall Street, not allowed to talk about stocks without a lawyer in the room because what?
He can't talk with a security analyst from his firm. Unless he has a lawyer in the room.
Because of the risk of corruption of analysis here.
Exactly, with the Grubman situation where he tried to influence Grubman to change his rating on AT&T and ended up giving $1 million to a nursery school in New York as a bribe.
And the whole flap. Samuel Hayes, at bottom, at the very base here, what are the stakes in this whole flap? Does this go to the ethical heart of Wall Street? Does it go to the American equity markets? For the American system of economics, of capitalism, what's at stake here?
Well, I think we have had and continue to have the most efficient capital markets in the world. And we have been and will continue to be the gold standard against which other markets around the world are measured. I think that what this is most importantly indicative of is the humiliation of some players in that marketplace.
That's it? That's all it is? Butter on your nose in the Hamptons?
No. Well, listen, when you say that's all it is, these are the major vendors on Wall Street. And so they are the street, and if they are cast in a bad light, they are going to suffer from a business point of view.
Well, how can you be the gold standard and utterly humiliated at the same time?
Well, because I said the markets are the gold standard in the world.
But aren't these markets pretty much held in the hands of these firms?
These firms are the major vendors in that marketplace. But remember now, we're talking about a particular sector of the marketplace. We're talking about the IPO market, mm-hmm. the initial public offering mm-hmm. market. Mm-hmm. And as was pointed up, in some cases, there were more mature companies raising additional funds.
So sure were.
We're talking about one sector of the market. It's the sector which is the most vulnerable to abuse, and it has been abused repeatedly in the past. And each time there have been reforms that have been implemented which have worked for a while, mm-hmm. and then, as happens with a magnet and gold filings, they go back to their previous patterns.
Yep.
So that's my point.
James Surowiecki, what's your sense here? We all know what happened with the market in the last few years, $7 trillion in value lost since, I think, March of 2000. Do you see a threat to the kind of fundamental engine, the fundamental mechanism of capital distribution in the United States in a lack of confidence? Or do we all, you know, have a good night's sleep, have a martini, and forget about it ultimately?
Well, I think I would say it's neither of those. I mean, I think that trust is obviously central to the efficient working of capital markets, just because, you know, in the simplest terms, you don't want to always have to be thinking and worrying about whether or not you're going to get rooked, you know, when you're making a deal. It's just a lot simpler. The more trust you have in a market system, the easier transactions are.
That's a simple comment, but in economic terms, that's a very big deal.
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, and it's very, very important, I think. I think it's very, very important. But I think it is naive and I think a mistake to look at the late 90s and say that the only problem or that the major source of that $7 trillion, you know, in market value being evaporated was Wall Street's, you know, malfeasance. In the first place,
now,
a lot of that $7 trillion that vanished was only that big because there was, you know, this kind of frenzy and this sort of mm-hmm. bubble mentality.
Mm-hmm.
So the relationship there is complicated. The second thing is that, and you sort of asked this when you were sort of asking your listeners, you know, Wall Street obviously has an enormous amount of influence and enormous amount of influence in terms of the way stock prices work. But ultimately, you know, stock prices are set not by Wall Street firms. They're set by the market as a whole. They're set by investors. And I think a huge chunk of what happened in the 1990s had to do with investors essentially throwing away a lot of the kind of rigor and sort of tough-mindedness that you want investors to bring. Now, I do think that, you know, there are consequences, and I do think that investors are hesitant to get back in. I'm not sure that's such a bad thing in the short term. You know, I think trying to look with a more jaundiced eye at companies is really what investors should have been doing all along.
Yep.
And so in that sense, it's not terrible.
Samuel Hayes, how do you look back on the 90s? Was this investors rooked or a kind of codependency here?
Oh, I think there was a good bit of codependency. I think it's just, as Mr. Surowiecki has pointed out, that you get a bull mentality that grips the whole society, in a sense, or the economic society, the business society, and I think that investors were riding it with great delight as long as it was going up, and I think that the vendors, that is the investment banks and the brokerage firms, are riding as well, and I think both contributed to the problem. So I think there's a long history of periodic bubbles that have taken place in our markets as well as in other parts of the world, and we've gone through a very dramatic one in the last several years.
And yet we don't want to take responsibility off these shoulders. I mean, there is an important enabling role when you look down that list of firms and it's buy. I mean, this is taking off the brakes that we're supposed to be able to presume are on. We're talking tonight with James Surowiecki of The New Yorker and Samuel Hayes, Professor Emeritus, Harvard Business School. You can join the conversation as well. 1-800-423-8255. John's calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Good evening.
Yeah. I think the settlement was at least one decimal point out of whack.
In which direction, John?
it should probably have been more along the lines of $10 billion plus. And the reason I'm saying this is that there was a confidence game in work here, and that the people who got the early IPO shares, they got in early on many of these companies,
right,
were the ones that benefited, and the people that bought afterwards and continued to buy, based on analyst advice, were the ones that got whacked. And this happened again and again and again. And, you know, my personal experience was, you know, I was offered an analyst job down on Wall Street, you know, $700,000 a year.
$700,000?
Yes.
Sounds like a responsible position. Did you snap it up?
No, I didn't.
And why?
The reason I didn't, you know, I was in the, you know, tech analyst community and up here in Boston, which is, you know, pretty, you know, well-respected.
Indeed.
And if you ever want to get into the tech analyst, you know, analysis, I'll be more than happy to kind of break down how those analysts actually made their decisions.
Well, I'm not sure. I don't know if we want to know if this is a this is public radio. I'm joking. But why didn't you go for a $700,000 analyst job on Wall Street, John?
Well, you know, I didn't want to mislead people. I didn't want to mislead, you know, people who are investing on their pensions and investing on, you know, what their futures are going to be, you know, over the long term. You know, tech analysis is a different thing.
But you felt that you would be obligated to mislead if you stepped onto Wall Street as an analyst?
Oh, sure.
I mean, it was that flagrant. It was that well known. It was that perfectly presumed.
Oh, most definitely. I mean, there is no way that an analyst that's working for any kind of firm, you know, brokerage or bank that is, you know, enticing investors to put money in can ensure the integrity of those analysts. And those analysts are entirely beholden. You know, I sat in many, many a room, you know, listening to analysts, you know, basically pledging their support for me and my company. and
raise your money with us, and boy, oh boy, are we going to talk you to the moon. But maybe they believed it, John.
Well, they didn't have to believe it. they wanted to believe it because they were going to make money from it.
Let me ask you one last thing. How do you change this? If you don't think $1.4 billion will change it, what would? Is it just decimal points? Is it just 10, 14, 40 billion? What?
It's a combination of decimal points, and it's a combination. The other part is taking all analysts away from the Wall Street firms.
Not letting the conflict of interest exist there. John, thanks for your call. James Sirwicki, how about it? I mean, John, technical analyst, he looks down there and it sounds he's just describing one big Wall Street whorehouse. Walk in and be debauched.
Well, I mean, I think there is this basic structural problem on Wall Street, and that is that, you know, Wall Street has two sets of customers. One is the companies that it wants to, you know, raise money for, do corporate finance deals with, and then their own individual investors, people who, you know, essentially have their money with brokers. And, you know, what you really saw in the late 90s was that there's this radical conflict between the two, because telling the truth about companies was not necessarily going to suit Wall Street's interests when it came to the corporate finance business. So I think that's an institutional problem. And the settlement goes, you know, tries to do some things about that. It makes the Chinese walls higher. I mean, I think literally analysts and investment bankers now have to be physically separated.
They can't sit on opposite sides of a glass wall or a cubicle.
Right, literally. And they're requiring, as I said, the investment banks to fund this kind of independent research, you know, presumably from firms like Morningstar or, say, Value Line. In terms of the IPO business, which the caller mentioned, the practice of spinning, which is to say giving IPO shares, essentially cheap IPO shares to, say, like the CEOs of firms that
potential
might
customers.
That practice has been completely banned as a result of the settlement, which is good. But I actually think that Wall Street is going to pay a price and already is paying a price in two very specific ways. One is, at this point, no one listens to Wall Street analysts with any level of seriousness.
They're a joke.
I think everyone kind of understands that, at least for the short term, those analysts have a long way to go to regain any kind of credibility.
Yep.
The second thing is that I think you're just going to see more and more people move their money out of Wall Street. Because, you know, the truth is there's no good reason, if you're an individual investor, to have your money with Merrill Lynch or Solomon Smith Barney as opposed to, say, with Charles Schwab or Vanguard, which is, you know, would be the – or even Fidelity, where you do not have these conflicts of interest. There's no reason to give your money to a company that basically has this inherent conflict of interest. And I think, you know, you're more and more people are realizing that. And I would anticipate that in the future – you know, more and more of that business is going to go to firms that don't have investment banking along with individual investors.
Well, that would be more than a slap of the wrist. That would be a radical conflict leading to a radical outcome. Jeffrey's calling from Hollis, New Hampshire. Hi, Jeffrey. You're on the air.
Hi. I was fascinated by the previous caller because he seemed to be wanting to whitewash the contribution that the high-tech analysts made to the incredible bubble there. I mean, their hands were just as dirty as everyone else's.
You're saying whether they were on Wall Street or not, Jeffrey?
Whether they're on Wall Street or not. But I'll tell you who was really responsible for it. A lot of it was the business press, which gave credibility to the Wall Street analysts when all the editors and all the writers knew that those guys were on the take. I know this because I'm a business journalist. I've written for Wired, Upside, Red Herring, a bunch of, you know, a number of different magazines.
So were you spinning yarns in the 90s, Jeffrey, or not?
No, as a matter of fact, I was blowing whistles. I was saying, writing the exact opposite stuff. I was saying that this, I was, and it was hard to get that, it was hard to get ink for that kind of coverage.
Well, you know, you talk a stock down, and the next time you turn around, it's worth 10 times what it was last week, and you've missed an opportunity in a bubble. Doesn't that happen?
It doesn't matter. You have to point out what the reality of the situation is. That's your job as a journalist. But I really think that particularly the major journals like Business Week and Fortune were incredibly gullible and gave those Wall Street analysts all kinds of ink and importance when they knew that these guys never, ever, ever said anything bad about a company.
Well, they made them rock stars. Jeffrey, thanks for your call. Samuel Hayes, what do you think of this? It sounds like at some point everybody's in on the poker game here. The analysts, the investors to some extent, having some idea. Certainly the business press took everybody for a big waltz, including themselves.
Well, it's certainly true that we've seen an explosion in the coverage of the financial sector by the business press, and particularly by the media, radio and television, and you know, cable channels devoted to nothing more than simply interviewing analysts and talking about the trends in the market. And I think that this has been fostered in part by the fact that we've changed our basic pension system in this country from a defined benefit where you work for a company and they give you 80% of your average of your last 5 years' salary mm-hmm. to a defined contribution system, which is represented by our 401ks and our IRAs. And so now each one of us has to become a portfolio manager for our own retirement assets. And so that concentrates the mind when you're talking about your own money and how it's going to work for you.
It also makes a lot of avid readers and subscribers for business journals. We'll come back and look at that some more. Stand by, Samuel Hayes, James Surowiecki. We're talking tonight about whacking Wall Street, the big Wall Street firm's $1.4 billion settlement this week for systematically misleading investors and where it leaves investor confidence in America. Have we made the crooked path straight here? Have we flushed the corruption out of the system? Have we really faced up to the problem? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston,
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about whacking Wall Street, the big Wall Street firms, top 10 Wall Street firms, $1.4 billion settlement this week with New York's Attorney General Eliot Spitzer for systematically misleading investors. What do you think? Are the sharks out of the Wall Street water yet? Will they ever be? Would honest analysis of equities have dissuaded you, or would you still have leapt at the 90s bubble? Are you confident that America's equity markets are now honest? We're at 1-800-423-8255. My guests tonight, Samuel Hayes, Professor Emeritus from the Harvard Business School, and James Surowiecki, financial columnist for the New Yorker magazine. And right now Mike is calling from Groton, Massachusetts. Hi Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to say that I think the point is that there was a bubble and that everybody got involved in that, but mm-hmm. part of Wall Street was bilking people out of their money. They were committing fraud. And, you know, we should go after the same laws that we use for, you know, the mafia. We should use RICO laws to regain everything that was lost. There's a money trail of everything that these people did. And, you know, and the other point is many of these trading houses hold licenses, you know, provided by the U.S. And my question is not only should they be punished, but why do we still give them licenses?
Mike, Yeah, that's great. You got your finger right on something, and I wanted to raise the same thing because we made much in the last segment of how everybody had kind of a role in this. There's blame to go around, but James Surowiecki, at the end of the day, isn't aren't these firms supposed to be the point in this circle where there's accountability? Aren't they supposed to be the circuit breaker in a way because there is some oversight?
Yeah, but it's a complicated question because, you know, the thing that's difficult about Wall Street is that although these firms are in some ways the gatekeepers to the capital markets, they are private entities. And so in a sense, the real problem, I mean, you could also think about this about the accounting industry, although I think with the accounting industry, it's maybe a little clearer that, in fact, they owe something to the public in a way that's sort of quite explicit. But if you think about Wall Street firms, and let's take the question of fraud, which the caller just mentioned, the question is, who were they bilking, and how did the bilking come? And I guess the only real argument is that they were bilking their own investors. That is, people who had given – Solomon Smith Barney was bilking people who had given money to Solomon Smith Barney to invest it. But when
was it really that simple, though? Because, of course, their recommendations resonated outside the ranks of their own investors.
Well, of course. But, I mean, you can't – it's hard to say that you can hold Solomon Smith Barney accountable for the fact that some people will listen to Jack Grubman. I mean, I don't know.
I mean, these people have a big position in our society and economy, and if they can stand up and just spout, you know, rubbish about firms, shouldn't they have some responsibility for that beyond their own immediate clients?
I mean, I would say they should, and I think from an ethical point of view they should. But do you really think that that Jack Grubman should be held legally responsible for the fact that I, who am not a Solomon Smith Barney client, listened to him and put my money into WorldCom? I mean, what this gets at actually is the strange position of Wall Street, which is I think what you're getting at is right. I mean, Wall Street is not just a private sort of a private industry. It has this, there's a public dimension to its work. But from a legal point of view, I mean, you know, whatever, people are theoretically allowed to say, we don't even know if Jack Grubman really believed it. Well, we do know about some of these companies, and that's why the emails were so telling. Mm-hmm. But it is complicated because, I was not a Solomon Smith Barney client. If I went ahead and listened to Jack Grubman, or I was not a Merrill Lynch client and I went ahead and listened to Henry Blodgett, in a sense, that was my choice. I could have just disregarded their advice. On the other hand, if you're a Merrill Lynch client and your brokers are putting – Merrill Lynch brokers are putting, you know, money into InfoSpace because Henry Blodgett is recommending it, even though he is privately deriding it, there I think you have a very clear case of fraud. And I think that's, you know, where – why Henry Blodgett is being banned from the security business, and I think it's why Merrill Lynch is going to have a hard time in the future continuing to fight these fraud suits.
Samuel Hayes, what do you think? Is there a more fundamental reform of these firms and the role of these firms? Is there a kind of they celebrate free markets, but in a way there's a cartel that sits along Wall Street. Should these firms, at least with their present functions, be run out of town for self-dealing?
Well, I think they ought to be threatened with that, and I think that they are, in a sense, almost like a public utility in that they have an access to the marketplace which others don't have. And I think that it was in recognition of that that we set up the Securities Acts of 1933 and 34, which place upon these firms and these vendors an obligation to police themselves. And I think what we see here is a failure of self-policing. And what distressed me about this settlement was that nobody went to jail. And I think that short of public of personal accountability in the form of jail time, it's easy to slough this off. And I would have liked to have seen some jail sentences meted out. I understand that the reason why they didn't do that was they were afraid that they'd get into long years of litigation in the courtroom, and with the resources that these investment banks has to bring to bear, perhaps they wouldn't have gotten anybody.
But
to
isn't
jail.
The opposite risk that without that, you get right back in trouble?
Well, that's true. But, you know, I also want to make the point that I think that individual investors are not the only investor group in this marketplace. We haven't mentioned the institutional investors.
So what's their role?
Well, they are, you know, we've been talking as though the individual investor is the sun and that the planets kind of revolve around that.
Of course they're not.
When, in fact, it's the institutional investors that's the sun.
Are you saying they were suckered, too, that they were somehow complicit? What?
They were, in some cases, were suckered, but not nearly to the the extent that the individual was. And in fact, the vendors were trying to cater to them. And in fact, were giving them some of the best deals. Some of these hedge funds got the best allocations of the IPOs because they were in a position to provide a lot of brokerage business.
And there we get right back to what looks to me like a fundamental problem here potentially, that this is, I mean, if you had an inside seat, an inner ring seat here, you were being dealt such beautiful hands. And who paid for that? I mean, it was a lot of individual investors who ended up with the empty 401k and an awful lot of people before the game was over. As one of our callers said, they went away from this table with millions and millions and millions. This seems wrong, just socially, structurally wrong, doesn't it, James Surowiecki?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it is wrong. And yeah, I actually agree with Professor Hayes that I've been thinking this a lot about both the Wall Street and also sort of more generally the kind of corporate scandals you've seen in things like Enron and Tyco that sending people to jail. At some point, somebody just has to, you know, you just want someone to go to prison, basically.
I mean, without that, I'm sorry to interrupt, but without that, doesn't the gang just sort of go back in the hills and sulk for a while until the town's folks are ready to be fleeced again?
Well, maybe to some extent, but I do think that ultimately, people are going to remember. And I think that, again, as I said, I do think that Wall Street has lost a lot of credibility in terms of, you know, individual investors. And I think I agree. I mean, I think that, you know, this is not an ideal settlement. I think that but I would also say I think the point about institutional investors is a very interesting one because it's a little bit hard to argue. I think you'd have a hard time arguing that institutional investors were really suckered in by Henry Blodgett, you know, recommending that Amazon that you should buy Amazon.
But Samuel Hayes is saying the opposite, that they understood the wink and the nod.
Right.
They got out when the getting was good. It's the little guy who didn't.
Well, yeah, except that, of course, most of these institutional investors are managing money for the little guy. I mean, mostly when we say institutional investors, what we really mean for the most part are pension fund managers or mutual fund managers. I mean,
I guess there's a range there,
but
the hedge fund guy, you know, can run, jump over the hedge and be gone. The others just can't get out of the market.
Sure. I mean, it's hard. It's obviously hard. And but I do think, again, that, you know, I don't want to, in any sense, sound Pollyanna. Well, actually, this would be the opposite of Pollyanna, I guess.
Okay.
But I do think we have to, like, go back and remember what it felt like in 1999. And,
pretty
wild. You know, it isn't just that everybody was incredibly cynical and was just corrupt. I mean, there was a sense in the late 90s that things were really different. I mean, some of that feeling was genuine.
I remember sitting in a room, Henry Blodgett at the head of the table, telling a group of investors, look, all you can lose is 100% of your money. you can make 10,000% perhaps, so put it down there. And with that, I'm afraid we're out of time. James Surowiecki, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
James Surowiecki is financial columnist and quite a fine one for the New Yorker magazine. And Samuel Hayes, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Samuel Hayes is professor emeritus at the Harvard Business School. We spoke earlier with Arianna Huffington, author of Pigs at the Trough. Listeners, you can continue the conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. In a moment, letters home from three American servicemen killed in Iraq. This is On Point. Last night, President Bush declared an end to major combat operations in Iraq. The president praised the courage, skill, and might of American armed forces and welcomed home, or at least on its way home, the aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln's 5,000 sailors. Bush also paid tribute to those who won't be coming home. Memories of those servicemen and women will be cherished by loved ones who watched them go off to battle and long for their return. Tonight, we read from what may be the final words written by three servicemen who were killed during the Iraq conflict. They are the words of men gearing up for battle with all the fear, pride, anxiety, and love that an unforeseen future at war portends.
Mom, I'm doing fine, and the smallpox shot was just temporary. I'm in better physical shape than I ever was before. The war will start soon, and I don't know what the outcome will be. Don't worry, though. It's nothing no one can change if something is meant to happen. Remember, if something should happen, mail those letters to Katie. Also, let everyone know I love them and will see them in time. It doesn't seem like anything can happen, but I imagine a lot of other soldiers thought the same thing. Saddam will be gunning for us here, but he has never been a good shot.
Well, today the temperatures hit 84 degrees, and it's expected to be the same for the next couple of days. I'm really not looking forward to the heat coming. I would have liked to have had this whole thing over with. Oh, well, there isn't much I can say or do about it. Today, we would have moved to a different location and been ready to go, but we've been ordered to stand down for further inspections going on. I don't really like that. It seems it's only going to get hotter, and Saddam is just going to be more prepared. I would rather have just kicked this pig and got on with it. I realize the diplomacy stuff, but this is getting ridiculous. I feel like an attack dog chained to a pole waiting for my master to cut me loose. We all know the only way home is through Baghdad, and we're ready. If this gets delayed any further, I'll find it more difficult to keep my soldiers busy. We've had a lot of good training thus far and have even gotten to do something that we wouldn't normally have done. All in all, it's good. Every day we become better prepared. Mom, please don't worry. I am in the most technically advanced fight force ever assembled, and we're only getting better. I'm in good hands, and we're all focused on doing our mission and getting everyone home safely. Well, that's about it. I have to go for now. I'll write again soon. Depending on when this gets to you, I may not be here. That doesn't mean the mail isn't working. It just means it'll be slower. I love and miss you all. I will see you soon. Your son, Tris.
Just a quick preface before I start in earnest. When I wrote this, you were 8, still a little boy. In 2002, I was called to active duty in the Marine Corps in the War on Terrorism. I knew on the 11th of September 2001, when America was attacked, I knew that I would eventually have to go, and I was filled with a deep sense of sadness. That night, as you and Kiko were asleep, I looked at your little faces and couldn't help but fight the tears. I knew it would be hard for you because I had a similar experience. When I was a little boy, age 6, my dad, your Grandpa Collie, was sent to Vietnam during the war there. I remember how much I missed him. But, being a little child, I didn't realize how hard it must have been on him, too. But now, unfortunately, I have come to realize just how rough it must have been for Grandpa to be away from his children for a year. Thinking about this, I wanted to put my thoughts and feelings down for you and your sister. I am sorry that I had to leave for such a long time. There is no place I would rather be than with you and Kiko. You two are the lights of my life. I have known no greater joy than in the few years since you two were born. I hope to have many more years with you. If this doesn't happen, then know that I love you more than words can express. If for some reason I don't make it home, I will need you to take care of your little sister and your mom. You will be the man of the Collie family. Be good, my son, and God will watch over you as he has me. I will be waiting impatiently for the time when we can all be together again. All my love, Dad.
Letters home. From Master Sergeant Robert J. Dowdy, Captain Tristan Aitken, and Staff Sergeant James Cawley. All three were killed during the war in Iraq. The letters were first published in the Washington Post. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by